Chapter 7. Looking Forward. How two theories of the future of America clashed and blended just after the Civil War. The one was abolition democracy based on freedom, intelligence, and power for all men. The other was industry for private profit, directed by an autocracy determined at any price to amass wealth and power. The uncomprehending resistance of the South and the pressure of black folk made these two thoughts uneasy and temporary allies. A printer and a carpenter. A rail splitter and a tailor. Garrison, Christ, Lincoln, and Johnson were the tools of the greatest moral awakening America ever knew. Chosen to challenge capital invested in the bodies of men and annul the private profit of slavery. This done, two quite distinct but persistently undifferentiated visions of the future dominated the triumphant North after the war. One was the prolongation of Puritan idealism, transformed by the frontier into a theory of universal democracy, and now expressed by abolitionists like Wendell Phillips, students of civilization like Charles Sumner, and leaders of the common people like Thaddeus Stevens, together with some of the leaders of the new labor movement. The other trend was entirely different and is confused with the democratic ideal because the two ideals lay confused in so many individual minds. This was the development of industry in America and of a new industrial philosophy. The new industry had a vision not of work, but of wealth, not of planned accomplishment, but of power. It became the most consciousless, unmoral system of industry which the world has experienced. It went with ruthless indifference towards waste, death, ugliness, and disaster, and yet reared the most stupendous machine for the efficient organization of work which the world has ever seen. Thus, the end of the Civil War was the beginning of vast economic development in the industrial expansion of the East, in the agricultural growth of the Middle West, in the new cattle industry of the Plains, in the mining enterprises of the Rockies, in the development of the Pacific Coast, and in the reconstruction of the Southern market. Behind this extraordinary industrial development, as justification in the minds of men, lay what we may call the Great American Assumption, which up to the time of the Civil War was held more or less explicitly by practically all Americans. The American assumption was that wealth is mainly the result of its owner's effort, and that any average worker can by thrift become a capitalist. The curious thing about this assumption was that while it was not true, it was undoubtedly more nearly true in America from 1820 to 1860 than in any other contemporary land. It was not true and not recognized as true during colonial times, but with the opening of the West and the expanding industry of the 20s, and coincident with the rise of the Cotton Kingdom, it was a fact that often a poor white man in America, by thrift and saving, could obtain land and capital, and by intelligence and good luck, he could become a small capitalist and even a rich man. And conversely, a careless spendthrift, though rich, might become a pauper, since hereditary safeguards for property had little legal sanction. Thus arose the philosophy of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves, on which the American theory of compensated democracy was built. It asked simply, in 18th century accents, freedom from government, interference with individual ventures, and a voice in the selection of government officials. The continued freedom of economic opportunity and ever possible increase of industrial income it took for granted. This attitude was back of the adoption of universal suffrage, the disappearance of compulsory military service, and imprisonment for debt, which characterized Jacksonian democracy. The American assumption was contemporary with the Cotton Kingdom, which was its most sinister contradiction. The new captains of industry in the North were largely risen from the laboring class, and thus living proof of the ease of capitalistic accumulation. The validity of the American assumption ceased with the Civil War, but its tradition lasted down to the day of the Great Depression, when it died with a great wail of despair, not so much from bread lines and soup kitchens as from poor and thrifty bank depositors and small investors. The American labor movement, founded in the spirit that regarded America as a refuge from oppression and free for individual development according to conscience and ability, grew and expanded in America, basing itself frankly upon the American assumption. Its object was rule by the people, the wide education of people so that they could rule intelligently, and economic opportunity of wealth free for thrift. It found itself hindered by slavery in the South, directly because of the growing belief of the influential planter class in oligarchy and the degradation of labor, and indirectly by the competition of slave labor and the spread of the slave psychology. It became, therefore, at first more and more opposed to slavery as ethically wrong, politically dangerous, and economically unprofitable. Capital, on the other hand, accepted widespread suffrage as a fact forced on the world by revolution and the growing intelligence of the working class. But since the new industry called for intelligence in its workers, capitalists not only accepted universal suffrage, but early discovered that high wages in America made even higher profits possible, and that this high standard of living was itself a protection for capital, and that it made the more intelligent and best paid of workers allies of capital, and left its ultimate dictatorship undisturbed. Nevertheless, industry took pains to protect itself wherever possible. It excluded illiterate foreign voters from the ballot, and advocated a reservoir of non-voting common labor, and it stood ready at any time by direct bribery or the use of its power to hire and discharge labor, to manipulate the labor vote. The true significance of slavery in the United States to the whole social development of America lay in the ultimate relation of slaves to democracy. What were to be the limits of democratic control in the United States? If all labor, black as well as white, became free, were given schools and the right to vote, what control could or should be set to the power and action of these laborers? Was the rule of the mass of Americans to be unlimited, and the right to rule extended to all men, regardless of race and color? Or if not, what power of dictatorship would rule, and how would property and privilege be protected? This was the great and primary question which was in the minds of the men who wrote the Constitution of the United States, and continued in the minds of thinkers down through the slavery controversy. It still remains with the world as the problem of democracy expands and touches all races and nations. The abolition democracy was the liberal movement among both laborers and small capitalists who united in the American assumption, but saw the danger of slavery to both capital and labor. It began its moral fight against slavery in the 30s and 40s, and gradually, transformed by economic elements, concluded it during the war. The object and only real object of the Civil War, in its eyes, was the abolition of slavery, and it was convinced that this could be thoroughly accomplished only if the emancipated Negroes became free citizens and voters. The abolition democracy saw clearly the difficulties of this step due to the ignorance and poverty of the freedmen. For the first time in classic democracy in the United States, it was made aware that the American assumption was not and could not be universally true. Some of the leaders of the labor movement even came to see that it was not true in the case of the mass of white labor. But that thought came to the abolitionists afterwards and in the minds of only a few clear-sighted men like Wendell Phillips. At the time of the Civil War, it was, however, perfectly clear to Sumner and Stevens that freedom, in order to be free, required a minimum of capital in addition to political rights, and that this could be ensured against the natural resentment of the planters only by some sort of dictatorship. Thus, abolition democracy was pushed towards the conception of a dictatorship of labor, although few of its advocates wholly grasped the fact that this necessarily involved dictatorship by labor over capital and industry. On the other hand, industrialists, after the war, expected the South to seize upon the opportunity to make increased profit by a more intelligent exploitation of labor than was possible under the slave system. They looked upon free Negro labor as a source of profit and considered freedom, that is, a legal doing away with individual physical control, all that the Negroes or their friends could ask. They did not want for Negro labor any special protection or political power or capital any more than they wanted this for Irish, German, or Scandinavian labor in the North. They expected some popular education and a gradual granting of the right to vote, which would be straitly curtailed in its power by mischief by the far larger power of capital. The South, however, persisted in its pre-war conception of these two tendencies in the North. It sought to re-establish slavery by force, because it had no comprehension of the means by which modern industry could secure the advantages of slave labor without its responsibilities. The South, therefore, opposed Negro education, opposed land and capital for Negroes, and violently and bitterly opposed any political power. It fought every conception inch by inch. No real emancipation, limited civil rights, no Negro schools, no votes for Negroes. In the face of such intransigence, Northern industry was, on the whole, willing to yield, since none of these concessions really obstructed the expansion of industry and capital in the nation. When, however, the South went beyond reason and truculently demanded not simply its old political power, but increased political power based on disfranchised Negroes, which it openly threatened to use for the revision of the tariff, for the repudiation of the national debt, for disestablishing the national banks, and for putting the new corporate form of industry under strict state regulation and rule, Northern industry was frightened and began to move towards the stand which abolition democracy had already taken, namely, temporary dictatorship, endowed Negro education, legal civil rights, and eventually even votes for Negroes to offset the Southern threat of economic attack. The abolition democracy was not deceived. It, at once, feared and dared. It wanted no revenge on the South and held no hatred. It did want to train Negroes in intelligence, experience, and labor, the ownership of land and capital, and the exercise of civil rights, and the use of political power. In the advocacy of these things, it reached the highest level of self-sacrificing statesmanship ever attained in America, and two of the greatest leaders of the ideal, Stevens and Sumner, voluntarily laid down their lives on the altar of democracy and were eventually paid, as they must have anticipated they would be paid, by the widespread contempt of America. Even to this day, the grandsons of abolitionists, ashamed of their fathers' faith in black men, are salving their conscience with a theory that democratic government by intelligent men of character is impossible when, in fact, nothing else is possible. And the grandsons of the planters and of the poor whites who displaced them are excusing their apostasy to civilization by charging the Negro with all the evil caused by war, destruction and greed, and by the deeds of white men, Northern and Southern. The abolition democracy advocated federal control to guide and direct the rise of the Negro, but they desired this control to be civil rather than military, like the strict government of territories, until new states should develop. They had to help them in the furtherance of this plan a degree of enthusiasm, humility, and hard work on the part of the depressed Negro, which is not paralleled in modern history. When now there were offered alliance with Northern industry, temporary military control instead of civil government, and then immediate citizenship and the right to vote for Negroes instead of a period of guardianship, they accepted, because they could not refuse, because they knew that this was their only chance and that nothing else would be offered. Their theory of democracy led them to risk all, even in the absence of that economic and educational minimum which they knew was next to indispensable. When Sumner saw his failure here, he went home and wept. But the belief in the self-resurrection of democracy was strong in these men and lent unconscious power to the American assumption. They expected that both Northern industry and the South, in sheer self-defense, would have to educate Negro intelligence and depend on Negro political power. The South was too astonished for belief when it saw industry and democracy in the North united for a policy of coercion. In the past, the South had always been able, by mere gesture of concession, to bring Northern industry to its knees, begging. It did not realize how strong industry had grown and how conscious its powers and how boundless its plans. It did not realize that the bases of the South's own power had literally been swept away, Even the West, on which the South had long counted in theory, although sympathy had seldom led to effective action, while it fought industrial monopoly, the national debt and the money power, yet when it had to choose between a continuation of Southern oligarchy and a great democratic movement, swung inevitably towards democracy. Northern capital went south and vied with the planters for the direction of the Negro vote. The poor whites scurried to cover, now here, now there, and a dictatorship of labor ensued, with a new democratic constitution, new social legislation, public schools, and public improvements. But of that we shall speak more in detail in later chapters. On the other hand, Northern industry seemed at last free and untrammeled. It began in 1876, an exploitation which was built on much the same sort of slavery which it helped to overthrow in 1863. It murdered democracy in the United States so completely that the world does not recognize its corpse. It established as dominant in industry a monarchical system which killed the idea of democracy. The basis of the argument for Negro suffrage has usually been interpreted as a gesture of vengeance, but it was much deeper than this. It was phrased first by Abraham Lincoln himself as a method of retaining the jewel of liberty in the family of freedom. This was echoed, however unwillingly, by Andrew Johnson as a sop to the radicals, but it gradually came in the thought of the nation to be an inescapable thing. Votes for Negroes were in truth a final compromise between business and abolition, and were forced on abolition by business as the only method of realizing the basic principles of abolition democracy. All of the selfishness, cunning, and power that were back of the new industry of the North have been looked upon as simply the other side of abolition democracy, and the reason for this was that in several cases the two ideas were mingled in individuals' minds. One can see that in the sermons of Henry Ward Beecher, who was a great advocate of votes for Negroes, but nevertheless instinctively capitalistic. Standing on the side of the exploiter, he had scant sympathy for the exploited. There was something of this, although not nearly as much, in the case of Thaddeus Stevens, who was at heart the greatest and most uncompromising of abolitionist Democrats, but who advocated not only universal suffrage and free schools, but protection for Pennsylvania iron. Yet in that protection, he had just as distinctly in mind the welfare of the laborer as the profit of the employer. What then was the strength of the democratic movement which succeeded the war? In many respects, it was emotional. It swept the land with its music and poetry, a war which, to the intense dissatisfaction of the abolitionists, had begun with the distinct object, even on the part of the great emancipator, to save and protect slavery, and in no way to disturb it, except to keep it out of competition with the free peasant of the West, had resulted in emancipation. Men like William Lloyd Garrison, who had no sympathy with the platform of the Republicans in 1860, became suddenly the center of the stage of the new dispensation. Thus, a legal metaphysical dispute involving the right of slave states to expand into the territories was rapidly changed, first to a question of freedom for slaves, and then to a struggle for inaugurating a new form of national government in the United States. When the physical war ended, then the real practical problems presented themselves. How was slavery to be effectively abolished? And what was to be the status of the Negroes? What was the condition and power of the states which had rebelled? The legal solution to these questions was easy. The states that had attempted to rebel had failed. They must now resume their relations to the government. Slavery had been abolished as a war measure. This should be confirmed and extended by a constitutional amendment. Some control of the Negro population must be devised in the place of slavery so as to introduce the Negro into his new freedom. The power of the national government had been greatly expanded by war. This expansion must be consolidated so that in the future secession would be impossible and slavery never reestablished. The difficulty with this legalistic formula was that it did not cling to facts. Slavery was not abolished even after the 13th Amendment. There were 4 million freedmen, and most of them on the same plantation, doing the same work that they did before emancipation, except as their work had been interrupted and changed by the upheaval of war. Moreover, they were getting about the same wages, and apparently were going to be subject to slave codes modified only in name. There were among them thousands of fugitives in the camps of the soldiers or on the streets of the cities, homeless, sick, and impoverished. They had been freed practically with no land, nor money, and save in exceptional cases, without legal status and without protection. Negroes deserved not only the pity of the world, but the gratitude of both South and North. Under extraordinary provocation, they had acted like decent human beings. They had protected their masters' families when their masters were away fighting for black slavery. They did this naturally because they were not sure that the North was fighting for freedom, and because they did not know which side would win. But at any rate, they did it. And even when they understood that the North, willing or unwilling, was bound towards freedom, and that they could fight for their own freedom, they were neither vindictive nor cruel towards their former masters, although they were quite naturally widely accused of laziness and impudence, which are the only weapons of offense which a rising social class can easily use. These black men wanted freedom. They wanted education. They wanted protection. They had been of great help to the Union armies, and that help had been given under great stress. Black soldiers had been outlawed, and in many cases ruthlessly murdered by the enemy, who refused to regard them as soldiers or as human. They took chances every time they put on a uniform, yet after the war, they were still not free. They were still practically slaves. And how was their freedom to be made a fact? It could be done in only one way. They must have the protection of the law, and back of law must stand physical force. They must have land. They must have education. How was all this to be done? Lincoln tried hard in the border states, long before the end of the war, to get voluntary emancipation and pay for the slaves so that a new system of labor under favorable circumstances could be arranged. The border states would have none of it. The war ended in anarchy, as war always ends. The cost had been so great that there could be no thought of pay for the slaves, even on the part of the South, after the first flush of Reconstruction. There was no possibility of paying for capital destroyed in other ways, or of quickly restoring the neglected land and tools. Thus, by the sheer logic of facts, there arose in the United States a clear and definite program for the freedom and uplift of the Negro and for the extension of the realization of democracy. Some of the men who had this vision were identified with the new industry, but saw no incongruity or opposition between their ideas or between the rise and expansion of tariff-protected corporations and their equally sincere beliefs in democratic methods. Others were not identified with industry at all. They were, some of them, rich men, supported by incomes derived from industry. Most of them were poor men earning a salary. Some of them were laborers. These men started from the abolitionists' point of view. Slavery was wrong because it reduced human beings to the level of animals. The abolition of slavery meant not simply abolition of legal ownership of the slave. It meant the uplift of slaves and their eventual incorporation into the body civil, politic, and social of the United States. There was, of course, much difference as to the exact extent of this incorporation, but less and less desire to limit it in any way by law. The Negro must have civil rights as a citizen. He must eventually have political rights, like every other citizen of the United States. And while social rights could not be a matter of legislation, they, on the other hand, must not be denied through legislation, but remain a matter of free individual choice. This outlook and theory of the abolitionists received tremendous impetus from the war. Those who had been classed as fanatics, who had been left out of the society of the respected and mobbed, North, East, and West, suddenly became the moral justification by which the North marched on to victory. All of the great literature of the Civil War was based mainly upon human freedom, and insofar as it stressed union, it had to make it liberty and union. The war songs, the war stories, the War of Flatus were based on the freedom of the slaves. Just as in the World War, we mobilized the mass of mankind in a war to end war and to promote the freedom and union of nations. Moreover, the new abolition democracy that came after the war had a tremendous and unexpected source and method of propaganda, And that lay in the crusade of the New England schoolmarm. The annals of this ninth crusade are yet to be written. The tale of a mission that seemed to our age far more quixotic than the quest of St. Louis seemed to his. Behind the mist of ruin and rapine waved the calico dresses of women who dared, and after the hoarse mouthings of the field guns rang the rhythm of the alphabet. Rich and poor they were, serious and curious, bereaved now of a father, now of a brother, now of more than these. They came seeking a life work in planting the New England schoolhouse among the white and black of the South. They did their work well. In that first year, they taught 100,000 souls and more. Here, for the first time, there was established, between the white and black of this country, a contact on terms of essential social equality and mutual respect. There had been contact between Negroes and white people in the Old South, and in some cases contact of beautiful friendship, and even warm love and affection. But this was spasmodic and exceptional, and had to be partially concealed. And always it was spoiled by the sense of inferiority on the part of the Negro, and the will to rule on the part of the whites. But in 1,000 schools of the South after the war were brought together the most eager of the emancipated blacks and that part of the North which believed in democracy, and this social contact of human beings became a matter of course. The results were of all sorts. Sometimes the teachers became disgusted. Sometimes the students became sullen and impudent. But on the whole, the result was one of the most astonishing successes in new and sudden human contacts. We must also remember that the population of the 60s was divided into church congregations, and the great majority of these Methodist, Baptist, Congregational, Presbyterian, and Quaker congregations in the North were represented directly or indirectly in the South after the war by one of their members who reported the work that she, and it was usually she, was doing with colored people. This work, to an unusual degree, was so successful and so helpful that her words carried widespread conviction. At the beginning of the war, probably not one white American in 100 believed that Negroes could become an integral part of American democracy. They were slaves and cowards, ignorant by nature and not by lack of teaching. Even if they were going to be freed, they must be got rid of or rid the land of themselves. During the war came the first real revulsion of feeling when it was found that Negroes could and would fight, were apt subjects for military discipline, and indispensable in the conduct of the war. Beyond that came the change in feeling when the rise of schools over all the South showed that the Negro would and could learn. There might be continued doubt as to the extent of the learning and the height to which the race could rise, but nobody in that day of widespread immigration from Europe could doubt that the Negro was capable of at least as much education as the ordinary northern laborer. Present America has no conception of the cogency of this argument. In 1865, the right of all free Americans to be voters was unquestioned, and had not been questioned since the time of Andrew Jackson, except in the case of women, where it interfered with sex ownership. The burden of the proof lay on the man who said there could be in the United States 4 or 5 million Americans without the right to vote. What would they be? What status would they hold? Would they not inevitably be slaves, in spite of the fact that they were called free? There were, to be sure, northern states which would not allow Negroes to vote, but many of the northern states did, and most of those that did not had comparatively few Negroes. The whole argument against Negro suffrage, even in those states, had been based on the status of the slave in the South. When the slave became free, a new problem was staged for such northern states. Two men stood in the forefront of this new attempt to expand and implement democracy: Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens. Sumner had been fighting steadily not simply against slavery, but for the manhood rights of the free Negro ever since he entered Congress. By amending the Act of March 3, 1863, he stopped discrimination on streetcars between Washington and Alexandria, and by the Act of March 3, 1865, extended this to all the railways of the district. June 25, 1864, by amending an appropriation bill, he stopped discrimination in the United States courts, a result which he called the most important of all in establishing the manhood and citizenship of the colored people. For this result, I have labored 2 years. He fought for equal pay to Negro soldiers and finally secured a favorable decision of the Attorney General. In 1863-1864, he fought unsuccessfully against white suffrage in the new territory of Montana. He tried to include colored citizens among the voters of the city of Washington, but lost again. At this moment of revolution, when our country needs the blessing of Almighty God and the strong arms of all her children, this is not the time for us solemnly to enact injustice. In duty to our country and in duty to God, I plead against any such thing. We must be against slavery in its original shape and in all its brood of prejudice and error. 4 years later, Senator Doolittle said that Sumner had always been in favor of pushing Negro suffrage. He was the originator of that notion. He is the master of that new school of Reconstruction. In December 1864, Sumner sketched an anti-slavery amendment. This was adopted by the American Anti-Slavery Society, and early in the session was moved by Ashley of Ohio and Wilson of Iowa in the House, and Henderson of Missouri in the Senate. Sumner yielded to Trumbull, who adopted the formula of the Ordinance of 1787, which finally became the 13th Amendment in 1865. Sumner secured a special committee on slavery and freedmen in the Senate in January 1864 and became the chairman. He introduced a bill to repeal all fugitive slave laws, and the committee reported it. Salisbury of Delaware wanted 1 day without the nigger. The bill was finally passed 27-12, and Lincoln signed it June 28, 1864. Sumner indeed assumed a mighty task, and one realized it as he stood February 5, 1866, before the Senate of the United States, before all the representatives that could crowd into the hall, before an audience including the whole nation and in some degree the whole world. He spoke 4 hours on 2 successive days. Public interest was intense. The galleries of the Senate were crowded, and there were a number of colored people, including Frederick Douglass and Henry Highland Garnett. The voice of the speaker was solemn and earnest. His style and presence held the audience to every word. Rarely, if ever, did he make a deeper impression in the Senate or awaken wider interest in the country. Thomas Wentworth Higginson found nothing in contemporary statesmanship, here or abroad, to equal the speech, and when Sumner sat down, the audience broke into applause. Charles Sumner was at the time 55 years of age, handsome but heavy of carriage, a scholar and gentleman, no leader of men, but a leader of thought, and one of the finest examples of New England culture and American courage. His speech laid down a Magna Carta of democracy in America. I begin by expressing a heartfelt aspiration that the day may soon come when the states lately in rebellion may be received again into the co-partnership of political power and the full fellowship of the Union. But I see too well that it is vain to expect this day, which is so much longed for, until we have obtained that security for the future, which is found only in the equal rights of all, whether in the courtroom or at the ballot box. This is the great guarantee, without which all other guarantees will fail. This is the sole solution of our present troubles and anxieties. This is the only sufficient assurance of peace and reconciliation. Our fathers solemnly announced the equal rights of all men, and that government had no just foundation except in the consent of the governed. And to the support of the Declaration, heralding these self-evident truths, they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And now the moment has come when these vows must be fulfilled to the letter. In securing the equal rights of the freedman and his participation in the government, which he is taxed to support, we shall perform those early promises of the fathers, and at the same time, the supplementary promises only recently made to the freedman as the condition of alliance and aid against the rebellion. A failure to perform these promises is moral and political bankruptcy. Twice already since rebel slavery rose, necessity has spoken to us, insisting, first, that the slaves should be declared free, and secondly, that muskets should be put into their hands for the common defense. Yielding to necessity, these two things were done. Reason, humanity, justice were powerless in this behalf, but necessity was irresistible, and the result testifies how wisely the Republic acted. Without emancipation, followed by the arming of the slaves, rebel slavery would not have been overcome. With these, the victory was easy. At last, the same necessity which insisted first upon emancipation and then upon the arming of the slaves insists with the same unanswerable force upon the admission of the freedman to complete equality before the law, so that there shall be no ban of color in courtroom or at the ballot box, and government shall be fixed on its only rightful foundation, the consent of the governed. Reason, humanity, and justice, all of which are clear for this admission of the freedman, may fail to move you, but you must yield to necessity, which now requires that these promises shall be performed. The freedman must be protected. To this you are specially pledged by the proclamation of President Lincoln, which, after declaring him free, promises to maintain this freedom, not for any limited period, but for all time. But this cannot be done so long as you deny him the shield of impartial laws. Let him be heard in court, and let him vote. Let these rights be guarded sacredly. Beyond even the shield of impartial laws, he will then have that protection which comes from the consciousness of manhood. Clad in the full panoply of citizenship, he will feel at last that he is a man. At present, he is only a recent chattel, awaiting your justice to be transmuted into manhood. If you would have him respected in his rights, you must begin by respecting him in your laws. If you would maintain him in his freedom, you must begin by maintaining him in the equal rights of citizenship. Foremost is the equality of all men. Of course, in a Declaration of Rights, no such supreme folly was intended as that all men are created equal in form or capacity, bodily or mental, but simply that they are created equal in rights. This is the first of the self-evident truths that are announced, leading and governing all the rest. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are among inalienable rights, but they are all held in subordination to that primal truth. Here is the starting point of the whole, and the end is like the starting point. In announcing that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, the Declaration repeats again the same proclamation of equal rights. Thus is equality the alpha and the omega, in which all other rights are embraced. Men may not have a natural right to certain things, but most clearly they have a natural right to impartial laws, by which they shall be secured in equal rights. Equality in rights is the first of rights. Taking the sum total of the population in the 11 states, we find 5,447,222 whites, to 3,666,110 colored persons. And you are now to decide whether in the discharge of your duties under the Constitution and bound to guarantee a Republican form of government, you will disfranchise this mighty mass, shutting them out from those equal rights promised by our fathers and from all voice in the government of their country. They surpass in numbers by at least 1,000,000 the whole population of the colonies at the time our fathers raised the cry, "Taxation without representation is tyranny." And now you are to decide whether you will strip them of representation while you subject them to a grinding taxation by tariff and excise, acting directly and indirectly, which dwarfs into insignificance everything attempted by the British Parliament. Let me be understood. What I especially ask is impartial suffrage, which is, of course, embraced in universal suffrage. What is universal is necessarily impartial. For the present, I simply insist that all shall be equal before the law, so that in the enjoyment of this right, there shall be no restriction which is not equally applicable to all. Any further question in the nature of qualification belongs to another stage of debate, and yet I have no hesitation in saying that universal suffrage is a universal right, subject only to such regulations as the safety of society may require. These may concern 1. Age, 2. Character, 3. Registration, 4. Residence. Nobody doubts that minors may be excluded, and so also persons of infamous life. Registration and residence are both prudential requirements for the safeguard of the ballot box against the nomads and bohemians of politics, and to compel the exercise of this franchise where a person is knowing among his neighbors and friends. Education also may, under certain circumstances, be a requirement of prudence, especially valuable in a republic where so much depends on the intelligence of the people. These temporary restrictions do not in any way interfere with the rights of suffrage, for they leave it absolutely accessible to all. The ballot is a schoolmaster. Reading and writing are of inestimable value. But the ballot teaches what these cannot teach. It teaches manhood. Especially is it important to a race whose manhood has been denied. The work of redemption cannot be complete if the ballot is left in doubt. The freedman already knows his friends by the unerring instinct of the heart. Give him the ballot, and he will be educated into the principles of the government. Deny him the ballot, and he will continue an alien in knowledge as in rights. His claim is exceptional, as your injustice is exceptional. For generations you have shut him out from all education, making it a crime to teach him to read for himself the Book of Life. Let not the tyranny of the past be an apology for any further exclusion. Having pleaded for the freedmen, I now plead for the republic. For to each alike the ballot is a necessity. It is idle to expect any true peace while the freedman is robbed of this transcendent light and left a prey to that vengeance which is ready to wreak upon him the disappointment of defeat. The country sympathetic with him will be in a position of perpetual unrest. Only through him can you redress the balance of our political system and assure the safety of patriot citizens. Only through him can you save the national debt from the inevitable repudiation which awaits it when recent rebels, in conjunction with northern allies, once more bear sway. His is our best guarantee. Use him. He was once your fellow soldier. He has always been your fellow man. I speak today hoping to do something for my country, and especially for that unhappy portion which has been arrayed in arms against us. The people there are my fellow citizens, and gladly would I hail them if they would permit it, as no longer a section, no longer the South, but an integral part of the Republic, under a constitution which knows no North and no South, and cannot tolerate any sectional pretensions. Gladly do I offer my best efforts in all sincerity for their welfare. But I see clearly that there is nothing in the compass of mortal power so important to them in every respect, morally, politically, and economically, that there is nothing with such certain promise to them of beneficent results. There is nothing so sure to make their land smile with industry and fertility as the decree of equal rights which I now invoke. Let the decree go forth to cover them with blessings, sure to descend upon their children in successive generations. They have given us war. We give them peace. They have raged against us in the name of slavery. We send them back the benediction of justice for all. They menace hate. We offer in return all the sacred charities of country together with oblivion of the past. This is our measure for measure. This is our retaliation. This is our only revenge. In the fearful tragedy now drawing to a close, there is a destiny, stern and irresistible as that of the Greek drama, which seems to master all that is done, hurrying on the death of slavery and its whole brood of sin. There is also a Christian providence which watches this battle for right, caring especially for the poor and downtrodden who have no helper. The freedman, still writhing under cruel oppression, now lifts his voice to God the Avenger. It is for us to save ourselves from righteous judgment. Never with impunity can you outrage human nature. Our country, which is guilty still, is paying still the grievous penalty. Therefore, by every motive of self-preservation, we are summoned to be just. And thus is the cause associated indissolubly with the national life. Strike at the black code, as you have already struck at the slave code. There is nothing to choose between them. Strike at once. Strike hard. You have already proclaimed emancipation. Proclaim enfranchisement also. And do not stultify yourselves by setting at naught the practical principle of the fathers, that all just government stands only on the consent of the governed, and its inseparable corollary, that taxation without representation is tyranny. What was once true is true forever, although we may for a time lose sight of it, and this is the case with those imperishable truths to which you have been, alas, so indifferent. Thus far the work is only half done. According to the best testimony now, the population of the earth, embracing Caucasians, Mongolians, Malays, Africans, and Americans, is about 1,300 millions, of whom only 375 millions are white men, or little less than one-fourth, so that in claiming exclusive rights for white men, you degrade nearly three-quarters of the human family, made in the image of God and declared to be of one blood. While you sanction a caste offensive to religion, an oligarchy inconsistent with republican government, and a monopoly which has the whole world as its footstool. Against this assumption, I protest with mind, soul, and heart. It is false in religion, false in statesmanship, and false in economy. It is an extravagance which, if enforced, is foolish tyranny. Show me a creature with erect countenance looking to heaven, made in the image of God, and I show you a man who, of whatever country or race, whether darkened by equatorial sun or blanched by northern cold, is with you a child of the Heavenly Father, and equal with you, entitled to all the rights of human nature. The second seer of democracy was Thaddeus Stevens. He was a man different entirely in method, education, and thought from Charles Sumner. We know Stevens best when he was old and sick, and when with grim and awful courage he made the American Congress take the last step which it has ever taken towards democracy. Yet, in one respect, Stevens, in his thought, was even more realistic than Charles Sumner, although Sumner later followed him. From the first, Stevens knew that beneath all theoretical freedom and political right must lie the economic foundation. He said at Lancaster, Pennsylvania, September 7, 1865, The whole fabric of Southern society must be changed. And it never can be done if this opportunity is lost. How can Republican institutions, free schools, free churches, free social intercourse exist in a mingled community of nabobs and serfs, of the owners of 20,000-acre manors with lordly palaces, and the occupants of narrow huts inhabited by low white trash? If the South is ever to be made a safe republic, let her lands be cultivated by the toil of the owners or the free labor of intelligent citizens. This must be done even though it drives her nobility into exile. If they go, all the better. It will be hard to persuade the owner of 10,000 acres of land who drives a coach and four that he is not degraded by sitting at the same table or in the same pew with the embrowned and hard-handed farmer who has himself cultivated his own thriving homestead of 150 acres. The country would be well rid of the proud, bloated, and defiant rebels. The foundations of their institutions must be broken up and relaid, or all our blood and treasure have been spent in vain. He figured that there were in the rebel states 465 million acres of land. Of this, 394 million acres were owned by 70,000 persons, each of whom possessed more than 200 acres. He argued that these 394 million acres ought to be confiscated by the government. To each adult freedman should be given 40 acres, which approximately would dispose of about 40 million acres. The remaining 354 million acres he would divide into suitable farms and sell to the highest bidder. Including city property, it should bring an average price of $10 an acre, making a total of $3.540 million in 6% bonds, the income of which should go towards the payment of pensions to the deserving veterans and the widows and orphans of soldiers and sailors who had been killed in the war. $200 million should be appropriated to reimburse loyal men in both North and South whose property had been destroyed or damaged during the war. With the remaining $3 billion, $40 million he would pay the national debt. Stevens argued that since all this property which has to be confiscated was owned by 70,000 persons, the vast majority of the people in the South would not be affected by this policy. These 70,000 were the arch traitors, and since they had caused an unjust war, they should be made to suffer the consequences. Sumner, thinking along these lines, had hesitated. He said in June 1862, when confiscation first was broached, "I confess, frankly, that I look with more hope and confidence to liberation than to confiscation. To give freedom is nobler than to take property. There is in confiscation, unless when directed against the criminal authors of the rebellion, a harshness inconsistent with that mercy which it is always a sacred duty to cultivate. But liberation is not harsh, and it is certain, if properly conducted, to carry with it the smiles of a benignant providence." Later, however, he began to see the economic demands of emancipation, and he wrote to John Bright, March 13, 1865, "Can emancipation be carried out without using the lands of the slave masters? We must see that the freedmen are established on the soil, and that they may become proprietors. From the beginning, I have regarded confiscation only as ancillary to emancipation. The great plantations which have been so many nurseries of the rebellion must be broken up, and the freedmen must have the pieces. It looks as if we were on the eve of another agitation. I insist that the rebel states shall not come back except on the footing of the Declaration of Independence, with all persons equal before the law, and government founded on the consent of the governed. In other words, there shall be no discrimination on account of color. If all whites vote, then must all blacks. But there shall be no limitation of suffrage for one more than for the other. It is sometimes said, 'What, let the freedman, yesterday a slave, vote?' I am inclined to think that there is more harm in refusing than in conceding the franchise. It is said that they are as intelligent as the Irish just arrived, but the question has become immensely practical in this respect. Without their votes, we cannot establish stable governments in the rebel states. Their votes are as necessary as their muskets. Of this, I am satisfied. Without them, the old enemy will reappear, and under the forms of law, take possession of the governments, choose magistrates and officers, and in alliance with the northern democracy, put us all in peril again, postpone the day of tranquility, and menace the national credit by assailing the national debt. To my mind, the nation is now bound by self-interest, aye, self-defense, to be thoroughly just. The Declaration of Independence has pledges which have never been redeemed. We must redeem them, at least as regards the rebel states which have fallen under our jurisdiction. Mr. Lincoln is slow in accepting truths. I have reminded him that if he would say the word, we might settle this question promptly and rightly. He hesitates. Meanwhile, I feel it my duty to oppose his scheme of government in Louisiana, which for the present is defeated in Congress. Stevens' declaration found new echoes. Senator Wade of Ohio was the only one who blazed a further path toward industrial democracy. He declared in public meetings that after the abolition of slavery, a radical change in the relations of capital and of property and land is next upon the order of the day. And Wade added frankly that this democratic movement of freedom and power for men was easily confused in men's minds with the older slogans of freedom for trade and industry. There is no doubt, he also remarked, that if by an insurrection the colored people could contrive to slay one half their oppressors, the other half would hold them in the highest respect and no doubt treat them with justice. All of this simply increased industry's fear of Western radicalism and was regarded as advocacy of industrial revolution. These were the demands of the extreme leaders of the abolition democracy. Leaders like Phillips and Douglas agreed with the demand for the ballots. Wendell Phillips said at the annual meeting of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society in 1865, "Our philosophy of government since the fourth day of July 1776 is that no class is safe, no freedom is real, no emancipation is effectual, which does not place in the hands of the man himself the power to protect his own rights. That is the genius of American institutions. The Negro must be given the franchise because we have no other timber to build states with, and unless we build with him, we must postpone Reconstruction for so many years that the very patronage of territorial government would swamp Republican institutions. Keep them territories. Let the democracy come in 8 years or four with the money power of this bank system in one hand and territorial government in the other, and Republican government will be almost a failure."